Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. There are certain figures in American history that just seem to be where the action is. In war and in diplomacy and politics and culture, there are just some folks who seem to be right in the thick of it, but usually for 10, 20, maybe 30 years. And then there's John Quincy Adams. From his youth witnessing the Battle of Bunker Hill to his adolescence in Europe under the tutelage of his father, John Adams, and other founders like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, to his astonishing career in politics as a minister to six countries, a senator, secretary of state, president, and then after his presidency, a return to Congress for many years right up until the day he died. In his life, John Quincy Adams bridged the gap between two of our country's most luminary figures. He served under George Washington and alongside Abraham Lincoln in Congress. And that resume just scratches the surface of a man often dismissed as merely an accidental president. Today on the program, we take a closer look at John Quincy Adams and the many roles he played in the first century of U.S. history. Our guest is Harlow Giles Unger, a historian and author of 20 books, including a half dozen biographies of founding fathers. He's also a former distinguished visiting fellow in American history at Mount Vernon, and his latest book is entitled simply John Quincy Adams. Harlow Giles Unger, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you with us. And as we begin our conversation, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome your questions on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. I suppose any discussion of John Quincy Adams probably should begin with his parents, John and Abigail Adams. Many parents have high expectations of their kids, but my perception is that John and Abigail Adams were in another stratosphere in terms of what they expected John Quincy to accomplish. How much pressure was he under as a child?
Well, pressure is not the right word, because children, especially children of well-educated, well-to-do families in America, grew up expecting big things of themselves. This was just expected. A boy like John Quincy Adams, with superlative parents like John Adams and Abigail Adams, was just expected to succeed. He was raised for greatness from the day he was born. His genes, courage and brilliance were in his genes. His ancestry goes back to the first Quincy Knight, who sailed with William the Conqueror to the Battle of Hastings. Another Quincy rode to Runnymede to force King John to signed the Magna Carta. So this was an illustrious family with an illustrious background, and he didn't think anything of it growing up, with great discipline, an insatiable appetite for learning and study. This was the norm for boys of his type.
In his early life, he was separated first from his father and then from his mother. For periods of time, stretches of years, in fact. What impact do you think that had on him and on his development?
Probably not too much in those days. Boys were raised to be independent. The parents were quite independent, and especially at that level of society. These were leaders of their society before independence and after independence, so that John Adams was expected to be at the Continental Congress. He was a prominent scholar and lawyer and legislator from Massachusetts. So he was away for 2 years. Yes, his wife missed him, and yes, his children missed him, but he wrote regularly. They wrote regularly to him. And meanwhile, Abigail took charge of John Quincy's education. He was their firstborn son, and therefore they expected the most of him. And when he was only seven, she heard cannon fire in the distance and took him by the hand. They climbed up the hill behind their farmhouse. They could see across Boston Bay and witnessed the Battle of Bunker Hill. They witnessed the slaughter there and immediately went back to their farmhouse, where Abigail built a big fire, and with seven-year-old John Quincy Adams helping her, they melted down the family pewter to make musket balls for the Patriot troops. So John Quincy Adams was serving his country along with his mother when he was only 7 years old, and he went on doing so for the rest of his life.
This sense of expectation that they're this family is part of a greater cause and the cause of this country is sort of underscored in a quote that you share in the book. When he's 12 years old, at this point in Paris with his father, hoping to return to the U.S. but unable to, there's a quote that Abigail writes to him, and I hope I get this right. There are the times in which a genius would wish to live. It is not in the still calm life that great characters are formed. When a mind is raised and animated by scenes that engage the heart, then those qualities which would otherwise lay dormant waken to life and form the character of the hero and the statesman. So she's saying to a 12-year-old, her son, you will be a hero and a statesman, and you need to pay attention to what's happening around you.
Well, when he was but 7 years old, at the time they were melting down their family pewter to make musket balls, she said to him, Abigail Adams said to her son, to 7-year-old John Quincy Adams, if you do not rise to the head of your country, it will be owing to your own laziness, slovenliness, and obstinacy. I urge you to fix unalterable resolutions in favor of virtue, integrity, and unchangeable love for your country. And that's how they raise their son, to be virtuous, to love and serve his country. It astounds me that so few Americans today know so little about this giant of a man, John Quincy Adams.
What makes him a giant of a man, in your mind?
Well, number one, he had this insatiable appetite for learning. So he became probably the most educated, best-prepared man for the presidency in the history of the United States. He was a courageous man. He, in John F. Kennedy's profiles in Courage, Kennedy, who himself a war hero, rated John Quincy Adams, listed him first, not because his name began with A, but because he was the most courageous senator and congressman in U.S. history. As a congressman, he stood up and made the first motions for abolition. And he was the first to stand up in Congress and fight for emancipation before Lincoln could even spell the word.
Go ahead.
He was a courageous public servant who always put the interests of his country first, never the interests of his region or state or community or any special interest groups. The country's interests came first.
What role did some of our founding fathers like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin play in John Quincy Adams' early life?
Well, they all played a role, some positive, some negative, some a little bit of both. Again, John Quincy Adams' lifespan of 80 years spanned the formative years of this country. He was a witness to the most important events in this country's early history and became an intimate of the most important characters in the history, the early history of this country, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, James Madison, James Monroe. He was a friend and an intimate of great figures overseas, like the Duke of Wellington, the Tsar Alexander, Frederick the Great of Prussia, Charles Dickens, Jeremy Bentham. So he knew the most important figures. He witnessed the most important events. And all of these had an enormous influence on his life.
It can't have been simply, of course, that he was John Adams' son and following his father around as he came across these figures. What was it about his personality, his experience, what he went through early on in his life that drew all of these figures to him?
Well, his father was unquestionably one of the most brilliant men in America, steeped in learning. And as was his wife, Abigail Adams. So the boy grew up in an environment in which learning and study was the primary activity. And he obviously had the mind of a genius. He had an insatiable appetite for learning. By the time he was 10, he had read five Shakespeare plays and could read, write classical Latin and Greek. By the time he was 15, he had read all 8 volumes of Thomas Hume's History of England, the 6 volumes work by Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, two volume classical economic texts by Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
He had read all of the Latin and Greek poets, Ovid, Tacitus. He had read all of the English poets, and he was just steeped in learning.
Well, he also traveled quite a lot in his teenage years.
By the time he was 16, he had covered the face of Europe, Scandinavian countries, Russia, Poland, Germany, France, Holland, England. At 16, he was named the Secretary of the Legation at the American Ministry in Russia. He spoke 6 languages by then fluently, and the appointed minister to Russia, Francis Dana, who was a friend of his father, couldn't speak French, and French was the language of international diplomacy and the language of the court in Russia. All the Russian aristocracy spoke French to each other. And John Quincy was fluent in French by then, and Francis Dana asked his father, could he take John Quincy Adams, 16-year-old boy, along with him as Secretary of the Legation to handle these foreign language problems in diplomacy. And John Quincy was Secretary of Legation for a year at the age of 16, already steeped in diplomacy. He had been in his father's care in Paris and Holland. They had lived in Franklin's chateau, Benjamin Franklin's chateau outside of Paris, and he had mixed with and spoken with on international affairs with the Prime Minister of France, Lafayette, all of the great figures in diplomacy in the Western world.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is historian and author Harlow Giles Unger. He's written a new biography of John Quincy Adams, and we're talking about the remarkable life, career, and legacy of our nation's 6th president. To join our conversation, you can call us this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. So John Quincy eventually does return to the U.S.
Yes, after his service in St. Petersburg, Russia, Secretary of Legation at age 16, he eventually comes back to the United States and enrolls at Harvard, his father's alma mater, as a second term junior, but finishes in a year, then finishes his law studies and begins practicing law, but also writing essays for newspapers. It was very common in those days for prominent thinkers to do so.
And these were letters of public cola?
That's correct. Yeah. All the essayists of that day wrote under pseudonyms so that it didn't affect their political careers, and also they avoided libel suits that way.
Mm-hmm.
They could say what they thought. His essays on international affairs were so profound they caught the eye of President Washington, who assumed it was his vice president, John Adams, that was writing these articles. But no, it was John Adams' son, John Quincy Adams, at the time 23-year-old lawyer in Boston. President Washington was so impressed, he asked John Quincy to come down to Philadelphia, which was the capital then, and appointed him minister at age 24, minister to Holland, which was a central listening post in Europe. John Quincy Adams became one of only 4 American ambassadors overseas, but his command of so many languages, he spoke 6 languages fluently by then, could understand 8 or 10. His command of foreign languages allowed him to mix with all of these diplomats in Holland, and understand what they were saying. He became a one-man intelligence service for the United States, our first true intelligence officer overseas. He gathered important information and data that he sent back to President Washington, and became such a consummate diplomat overseas that, of course, when President Monroe was elected president, although he was from the opposite political party, he appointed John Quincy Adams Secretary of State, and John Quincy Adams went on to become probably the greatest American Secretary of State in history. He engineered the annexation of Florida and the extension of American territory to the Pacific Ocean, and he wrote the core provisions of the famed Monroe Doctrine, which warned Europeans and all foreign nations never again to try to colonize lands in the Americas.
Now, before he became Secretary of State, though, he was in the, do I have this right? He was in the U.S. Senate first?
He had been in the Senate, and it was here, it was in his Senate role that John F. Kennedy, who had been a senator before he was president, was absolutely fascinated with John Quincy Adams's role there. Although he was elected by a political party that then existed called the Federalists, he refused to toe the party line. He only voted for or against bills in the Senate on the basis of whether or not he felt this was in the best interest of the whole country. So he voted against his party in favor of President Jefferson, who was from the opposite political party, in favor of President Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase. John Quincy Adams was the deciding vote, and he went against his party's instructions. Then he turned around and went against President Jefferson when Jefferson decided he wanted to tax the people of Louisiana, and John Quincy said, well, you can't do that. Only the House can levy a tax. The president cannot arbitrarily tax people. So he defeated President Jefferson's efforts to tax the people of Louisiana directly. And then he again fought President Jefferson's attempt to strip the Supreme Court of justices who had political opinions that differed with those of Jefferson. Jefferson tried to have he succeeded in getting the House to impeach Senator Justice Samuel Chase, and Chase went on trial before the Senate. John Quincy Adams gave one of the most moving defenses of speech of Chase, saying that high crimes and misdemeanors in the Constitution refer to indictable criminal acts, not to political dissent, and that Jefferson was trying to punish Chase for his political views that were opposed to those of Jefferson. And thanks to John Quincy Adams's eloquent, they called him Mr. Eloquent, his eloquent defense of Samuel Chase in the Senate, Chase went back to the Supreme Court and served out his served on the court the rest of his life. And Jefferson was humiliated.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is historian and author Harlow Giles Unger. He's written a number of biographies about our founding fathers, and his latest looks at one of the key figures of the very next generation, John Quincy Adams, son of John and Abigail Adams, and the sixth U.S. president. We welcome you to the conversation with any questions or comments you may have for our guest at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You write that most of John Quincy Adams' Senate colleagues ultimately viewed him as a, quote, chronic malcontent. Was he? Were they wrong?
In many instances, they were correct, but what he was unhappy about was their tendency to tolerate corruption. He fought corruption, he fought bigotry, and he fought for the interests of the country. Most senators and almost all congressmen go to the Capitol, and they really ignore the interests of the country in trying to push the interests of their own constituency. That's what they were elected for. A local congressman goes to Congress because is elected to Congress because he promises the people of his district that he's going to build a canal through there or bring a railroad through there or something to improve the economy of that particular district, and the rest of the country just go to the devil, pay for it, that's all. Well, John Quincy Adams refused to do that. And so he fought all of these special interest groups all of his life in Congress.
Well, and something you point out in the book that I found rather ironic was how he found his way into the U.S. Senate. If I understand this correctly, he was in the state Senate, but his fellow Federalists were becoming frustrated about his campaigns against corruption. So they kind of just wanted to get him out of the way within the state Senate. So they said, well, let's nominate him for the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Exactly. In those days, the senators were not elected by the people. U.S. senators were elected by each state legislature. So it was the state legislature that elected him to the Senate because he was causing so much trouble in the state legislature. They wanted to get him out of Boston, and they sent him down to Washington.
And that seems like a somewhat short-sighted view to say, well, we'll send him to the U.S. Senate where maybe he'll be out of our hair, but at least in their minds, if they're trying to avoid someone fighting against corruption, well, he's going to be able to accomplish quite a bit in the U.S. Senate at that point.
Well, I've not met too many politicians that are not short-sighted.
All right. With that thought in mind, let's take a call. Let's go to Rich. He's calling in from along I-55. Rich, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Morning. Question, John. John Adams was known as a fairly conservative religious figure at that time. What were John Quincy Adams' religious views? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, thanks for the call.
Well, they were both very religious men. They grew up in the Puritan tradition, which we now call the Congregational Church. But neither of them ever allowed religion to interfere with their political lives. They both strongly believed in separation of church and state and never allowed their religious beliefs to interfere with what they did as politicians, which is why one of the reasons that the name God, certainly not Jesus Christ, do not appear in any of the great political documents that were used to found this country.
There are a couple of moments in John Quincy Adams' political life when, as I was reading your book, I was reminded that our 21st century perceptions of where political power resides maybe are quite different from the attitudes in the early 19th century. And I mentioned the one about this idea of the state Senate, that his fellow Federalists put him up to go to the U.S. Senate as much to get him out of their hair at the state level. But there was another example of this, and I did not know this about John Quincy Adams. He was offered a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court and turned it down.
Yes. He thought it would be boring. because, remember, the primary role of the Supreme Court, although it was changing radically under John Marshall, the primary role under the Constitution of the Supreme Court was an appellate court. They could not originate any kind of legal cases except those having to do with treaties and foreign commerce. They tended to stick to that role quite a bit, although, as I say, it was changing. And John Quincy Adams, and the Supreme Court only met a couple of times a year for very short periods of time. And John Quincy Adams just thought it would be boring. The other aspect of the Supreme Court also was that they rode circuit, and he did not want to ride circuit. But in terms of the roles and who held political power, you have to remember, too, that in those days, only white male property owners could vote. So the vote was in the hands everywhere. Was in the hands of a economic and political and educational elite, and most Americans deferred to that elite. Joe the plumber did not have ideas about being president.
Right.
He deferred to the local merchant, the local banker, and the local judge, and said, "You know more about government. You handle that. I'll handle the plumbing." And that's the way things were until Andrew Jackson came along, and it was during the Jackson administration. He was the first great populist who lobbied for and got most states to change the voting laws and allow all white males, whether they own property or not, to vote. Women's vote was still a century away, as was, and the black vote, of course, was quite a ways away in many, many states.
To reinforce the impact that John Quincy Adams had on history, the first century of American history, really, there are other subjects that we really must talk about in the second half of the show, the War of 1812, the Missouri Compromise, and then, of course, John Quincy Adams' experience as president, arguing before the Supreme Court. There's so much more, and I want to get to that. But just a quick reminder, we are taking your questions and comments about John Quincy Adams for biographer Harlow Giles Unger, and you can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we will take more of your phone calls as well as emails that come in after a short break. This is Focus.
In 2009, Susanna Cahalan was hospitalized following a seizure and increasingly psychotic behavior.
That moment for me is the difference between sanity and insanity, and that moment where kind of my memory goes dark.
On the next Fresh Air, Cahalan talks about the rare immune disorder that was attacking her brain. She's written a new memoir. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping Central Illinois families achieve financial security and protect their home, family, and property since 1990. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing the life, career, and legacy of John Quincy Adams on today's show with biographer Harlow Giles Unger. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. So I alluded to a number of other events that occurred that John Quincy Adams had an impact on as well. Let's talk a little bit about the War of 1812. What role did he have in ending that war?
Well, he was, at the time, he was American ambassador to Russia in St. Petersburg, and James Madison, our president, recognized John Quincy Adams as our greatest foreign diplomat, as had George Washington. John Quincy Adams had, well, his brilliant education and his gift in foreign languages allowed him to become friends and intimates of the most cantankerous foreign leaders in the world. He became a good close friend of Frederick the Great, Tsar Alexander of Russia, and Lord Castlereagh, who was the foreign minister of Britain, was all for absolutely wiping out the U.S. In the War of 1812. The U.S. had started the war. They had not. And, in fact, Britain was ready to make peace with the United States when we invaded Canada. So Castlereagh was absolutely furious with the Americans. John Quincy Adams, President James Madison, appointed John Quincy Adams to go to a neutral site in Belgium, Ghent, the city of Ghent, mm-hmm. to negotiate with Lord Castlereagh. And not only did John Quincy Adams manage to negotiate an honorable peace that ended the War of 1812, he and Castlereagh became great friends. Castlereagh had never met an American who was as superbly educated, probably more so than any of the best educated men in England. John Quincy Adams' erudition was absolutely remarkable. And, speaking of his erudition, one thing we forgot to mention was his deep interest in science. As a boy in Paris with his father as a 10-year-old, Paris was the center of scientific advances in the Western world at the time, and he witnessed the first balloon flights, both unmanned and manned, including one across the English Channel. He met the pilot of that balloon, introduced the pilot to his mother, and became fascinated with the heavens and the stars. And when he was president, he asked Congress to appropriate funds to build what he called lighthouses to the sky, astronomical observatories that could map the heavens. Congress refused to do anything he asked while he was president, and it was later as a congressman that he sponsored the construction of a network of these lighthouses to the sky, astronomical observatories, one at the Navy Department in Washington, another at West Point Military Academy, another at his alma mater, Harvard. He spent $1,000 of his own money to contribute to that, and one in Cincinnati on a hilltop which was renamed and is still named Mount Adams. And this network mapped the heavens for the very first time and traced the paths of the planet, first time in America. So John Quincy Adams was the father of space exploration in this country, a century before other Americans even thought of it.
What was his attitude towards the Missouri Compromise in 1820, which admitted Maine as a free state, Missouri as a slave state?
Well, it was the only way out. Slavery was an insoluble issue by then. Everybody thinks that the founding fathers had something to do with slavery. They inherited this problem. The slavery began in the early 1700s, late 1600s, early 1700s, before the founding fathers were even born. At the time, at the beginning of the early 1700s, the English had imported about 10,000 to 15,000 slaves into the South, and in Virginia, particularly the tobacco country. The Virginians were furious and petitioned Queen Anne to stop sending slaves into Virginia, that the tobacco plantations needed highly skilled workers to plant and harvest and treat tobacco. The slaves were, number one, they couldn't speak English. Number two, the vast majority were illiterate. And number three, they were a burden. They didn't want to work hard. After all, they weren't paid to work. And peace workers in the North were far more productive. So Virginians were against this. Queen Anne, however, her treasury depended on the slave trade. And she kept the slave trade alive. And by the time our founding fathers were in control of this country, you're talking about 500,000 slaves in Virginia alone. Where would they go? What would they do? There, in the North, they could free the slaves because you had manufacturing facilities where they could start work as apprentices and learn trades. In the South, the only work was for field hands. There were no towns and cities and villages in the South. You had a few cities along the coast, and that's it. The road out of one plantation met the road into the next plantation. Each plantation was self-sufficient. So where would these slaves go? How would they feed themselves? Where would they work? It was an insoluble problem.
And then, you know, fast forward to 1820 and John Quincy Adams, witnessing a part of the Missouri Compromise and then the years that follow. Do you think at that point he sees this as a necessary compromise, but that an eventual civil war may be inevitable?
He predicts a civil war at this point. The South, by that time, the South had grown dependent economically on the slaves because now you no longer had a tobacco culture. You had cotton and rice, where slaves, you didn't need skilled laborers. Unskilled laborers could handle both crops. And so the South had become dependent on slaves for their economy. Meanwhile, in the North, because of John Adams's appeal for abolition and emancipation, the abolition movement was growing and intensifying. So the North was demanding abolition and emancipation. The South said, not a chance. The only way was that we could continue as a union was to compromise, and the Missouri Compromise, with the admission of Missouri, the compromise was to keep the balance in the Senate even between slave states and free states.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri was a slave state. With its admission, it would have given the slave states a majority of votes in the Senate. Fortunately, Maine split off from Massachusetts and applied for statehood, and that provided the compromise. At that point, they then drew a line westward, west of Missouri, saying any new states in the west above that line become free states, below that line become slave states. And that was the compromise, which really just kicked the can down the road.
Yeah. Let's take another call. We have a listener on the line from the central Illinois town of Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning, and how are you all today?
Well, thanks.
The question I had is, and it's, I'm sorry, it's going to get off the Missouri Compromise and the slave aspect.
That's
of it.
Fine.
But I was wondering, Benjamin Franklin and his son did not have a very good relationship. Why, I'm not totally sure. But John Quincy Adams and John Adams, they seemed to spend a lot of time in England together when John Adams was there negotiating the independence. Obviously, he got a very good education, but I'm sure Benjamin Franklin's son got a very good education. What was their relationship between two powerful, both of these are powerful men that had interesting sons. How was the relationship between John and John Quincy?
First of all, Benjamin Franklin's son was much, much older than John Adams's son. Benjamin Franklin's grandson was a contemporary of John Quincy Adams. Benjamin Franklin's son was the royal governor of New Jersey and a loyal British subject. And Benjamin Franklin was for independence. His son was not, and that's why they fell out. They fell out over this bitter political dispute. John Quincy Adams and his father never had that kind of dispute because the country was an independent country, as John Quincy Adams grew up. There was never any conflict there.
Let's talk a little bit about John Quincy Adams as president. First of all, he became our nation's sixth president, but not in the way that we elect presidents today. Could you talk a little bit about how it was he came to be president?
Yes, John Quincy Adams, like his father, John Adams, believed it was beneath the dignity of a presidential candidate to run around the country making promises that he probably wouldn't be able to keep. Fortunately, no politicians do that today. he refused to do that and said that the American people should have the good sense to elect a president who has the most talents and has performed his obligations as a public, has best performed his obligations as a public servant. Well, he was wrong. He did not get a majority of the votes. Andrew Jackson did, but Jackson did not have the majority of votes in the Electoral College. And when that happened at that time, it would still be the case today, if a candidate did not have a majority of votes in the Electoral College, the vote for the presidency is then thrown into the House of Representatives. And it was there that John Quincy Adams was elected president. As president, because he was a minority president, and there was this growing ferment for populist ferment to expand the vote to all white males, universal white male suffrage was the theme. He never had the support of the House, and the House blocked every legislative measure he proposed, including the great space exploration program that he had proposed. And in the next election, because by then enough states had expanded the vote to include all white males rather than just property owners, he lost the election to Andrew Jackson.
One of the captions in your book refers to him as the most ineffective president in early American history.
Yes, he was oddly enough the only son of a founding father president to be elected president himself, and he was unable to get any of his great measures through Congress as president. He managed to get a lot of them through the Congress when he then became a member of the House of Representatives.
And that's really interesting, because I think that's something that today would be almost unimaginable, that someone would serve as president and then go into Congress.
Well, I think it's a disgrace that our presidents retire and then have nothing more to do with the country. They go out and make $1 million selling books or giving speeches instead of continuing to serve this country. I think if you're elected president, you have an obligation to keep serving in some capacity afterwards. If not in an elected capacity, then in a volunteer capacity. But John Quincy Adams, when he was defeated, went home to Massachusetts, and the people of Massachusetts said, no, we need you. We need a man like you in government. And so he returned and served out his life the next 16 years, 8 consecutive terms in Congress, and served there till the day he died. He stood to make a motion to end the war, to end the Mexican War, and as he tried to make the motion, he collapsed into a colleague's arms and died in the House of Representatives 2 days later, still serving his country. And I think every American president should continue to do so, if they're capable. Obviously, Ronald Reagan was not capable.
Right. Since we've reached that era, that final 16-year period in his life, that also involves another interesting moment for him where he appears before the U.S. Supreme Court. And we have a caller, Arthur from Carlock, Illinois, who has a question about that. Arthur, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I wanted to ask a question about the Amistad, the incident where the slaves overthrew the crew and took over, were put on trial.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks.
So, this is one of the great accomplishments of John Quincy Adams' career. He was one of America's, if not America's, greatest lawyer at the time, pleading many cases. This was while he was in the House of Representatives. He pleaded many precedent-setting cases before the Supreme Court. And one of the greatest of his cases was the famous case of the Amistad. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, may have seen the film Amistad with Anthony Hopkins playing the role of John Quincy Adams. What the film doesn't make clear is the importance of that case, or certainly as much as the human drama of the case. But in it, at that time, all Africans, anyone with black skin, was considered a slave. And the slave trade between Africa and the United States was considered a legitimate commercial venture. But John Quincy Adams said, no, these are not slaves, these were freemen. These were freemen who had been kidnapped and had risen up in legitimate self-defense against their kidnappers and killed the captain and mate of the Amistad and took control of the ship, that this was legitimate self-defense against the crime of kidnapping. And the Supreme Court, many of them slaveholders, upheld Adams's brilliant argument. And what that Supreme Court decision did, what John Quincy Adams accomplished, was to make the slave trade illegal. It was no longer a legal commercial venture. It changed the complexion of the slave trade. It made it a crime. Kidnapping. It was a crime. This didn't end slavery. That would come later. But it broke the back of the pro-slavery forces, because it now made slave trade between Africa and the United States illegal. It made it a case of criminal kidnapping.
You write that John Quincy Adams spent most of his life tilting at political windmills. Was this the biggest windmill?
Certainly one of them. Another one, of course, was defending Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, with whom he often disagreed. He didn't particularly like Chase. Was a real cantankerous, argumentative, often mean-spirited fellow. But Jefferson tried to silence Chase and remove him from the Supreme Court because of his political views. And John Quincy Adams said, that is not a crime, high crime and misdemeanor under the Constitution, and you can't do it. And he stood up in the Senate and defended Chase and won Chase's acquittal so that Chase could go back to the Supreme Court. Chase was learned a good lesson from it, though. He stopped expressing political views from the bench. Hmm. So from that standpoint, it was a good lesson for all the members of the Supreme Court. Until very recently, Supreme Court justices really kept their mouths shut when they took off their black robes.
Do you see a parallel between the impeachment of Chase and John Quincy Adams standing up in the Senate to defend his right to speak his mind, and at the end of John Quincy Adams' life when he's in the House, there's this gag rule instituted over debate surrounding slavery, and he stands up against that as well.
Yeah.
Is it sort of the same argument?
Absolutely, the same argument. But the Chase case is somewhat different because here a justice of the Supreme Court, a public official, is being impeached under the Constitution. And the Constitution says that a judge serves for life unless he is found guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors. So the Chase case really defined what the Constitution means by high crimes and misdemeanor. It means an indictable criminal offense, which was what made President Clinton's impeachment so startling that the House and the Senate would forget this monumental case of Samuel Chase, sexual adventures, no matter what they are, do not constitute high crimes and misdemeanors, period. And how they thought they could impeach the president on the grounds of a sexual misstep, sexual adventure, is just astounding and shows you how ignorant of the Constitution so many members of Congress are today.
What should we remember or recognize about John Quincy Adams that you think, in general, Americans don't?
His love and service to his country and his defense of the Constitution and the major documents that went into founding this country, his insistence on abolition, emancipation of slavery. He was the first champion of emancipation. The Declaration of Independence, and Jefferson helped write it, said all men are created equal, and then he went home and made his slaves get back to work. Other founding fathers were in favor of emancipation. George Washington, Patrick Henry, all were in favor of abolition and emancipation, and John Quincy Adams was the first to stand up in Congress and champion the cause of the underprivileged, the disenfranchised, and the other Americans. As Romney put it, the 47%. John Quincy Adams was their champion.
We have just a minute or so left. I'm curious, you've had the opportunity to sort of select who you're going to take some time to really explore in depth as you've written these biographies, I guess a half dozen or so, of founding fathers. What drew you specifically to John Quincy Adams versus, oh, I should take on James Monroe or somebody else?
Well, I actually did write on James Monroe.
Right. I picked the wrong one.
Actually, I had run out of ideas. Others had written on Jefferson and Franklin and Madison, and I had written on Monroe, on Patrick Henry, on John Hancock, on Washington. And I pulled off my shelf John F. Kennedy's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage. And there in chapter one was John Quincy Adams. Well, I thought, Adams, it begins with the letter A. No wonder he's in chapter one. But that was not the reason. Daniel Webster was in chapter three, and Thomas Hart Benton with a B was in chapter four. Kennedy, who was himself a war hero, had listed these senators and congressmen in order of degree of courage. And he listed John Quincy Adams as the most courageous senator and congressman in American history. And I had to get to know this man, and that's why I wrote John Quincy Adams.
Harlow Giles Unger is a historian and author of 20 books, including a half dozen biographies of founding fathers. He's also a former distinguished visiting fellow in American history at Mount Vernon, and his latest book is entitled simply John Quincy Adams. Mr. Unger, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me on your show. I appreciate it.